I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Paul Barnes. He's a film editor, collaborator, and co-producer with filmmaker Ken Burns. He's the editor of Ken Burns' Civil War series. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me, Mary Charlotte.
And Meredith Davidson joins us. She is curator of 19th and 20th century Southwest collections at the New Mexico History Museum. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So there's a new exhibition at the History Museum that's opening tonight called Fading Memories, Echoes of the Civil War. What's that show about?
Well, we're really excited to be bringing this exhibit to the History Museum. About a year and a half ago, the Santa Fe Opera approached us because they were in the early stages of planning the premiere of Cold Mountain, an interpretation of Cold Mountain for their 2015 cycle. So we decided in conjunction with them to come into a partnership and explore in a very small exhibit. It's really just 500 square feet. It's a very small exhibit on the history of the Civil War and the way that we've remembered the Civil War over the 150 years since its conclusion, which is marked by this year.
So what are the kind of objects that you can put in a museum exhibition of this kind?
Sure. Well, I think a lot of people don't necessarily, who aren't terribly well-versed in Civil War history, may not even know that the Civil War touched New Mexico at all. We're really fortunate to have some pieces that speak directly to those engagements in New Mexico, including a Civil War flag, a 9-foot flag that was made by the Ladies of Denver in 1861 and carried down through Colorado into New Mexico and was present at the Battle of Glorieta, which is a very seminal moment in the New Mexico side of the Civil War story, because that's when the Confederates were turned back and didn't make it any farther to the West Coast, which was their plan originally. So that's a really special piece that speaks to the engagements in New Mexico itself. And really what we wanted to do in this exhibit was take a bigger view of not just those engagements, but like I said earlier, the ways that we have and can remember the Civil War and the ways those conversations have changed over the generations. So another aspect of the exhibit that's really special is we've pulled from our photo archives. Our photo archives have over 1 million images in their collections.
They must all be categorized.
Oh, yeah.
Are they all digitized?
No, but there's a large portion of the collection is digitized. We've worked very hard to have quite a bit digitized, and we're lucky enough to be one of the few collections in the Southwest to have a fairly robust collection of cased images of daguerreotypes and amber types and tin types, which were the contemporary photography form during the Civil War. And so we've pulled a whole selection of those that speak so beautifully to the things that we don't know about the Civil War, the unidentified soldiers in these images and the unidentified women and children that may have lost someone in the war are some of the most, I think, touching aspects of the exhibit. In the vein of memory, we also have several pieces that speak to the first and second generation's efforts to recontextualize the Civil War. So we speak a little bit about the way that Lincoln's death and reporting of his death is remembered and put out in popular culture mediums like Harper's Weekly. So there's some aspects of that that speak to the memory aspect. And pieces that we aren't able to speak to directly in the exhibit, we have a really robust schedule of public programs that are for the most part free and open to the public that go all throughout the year, and we're really excited about our first one, which will be May 8th with Paul Barnes.
Yes, indeed. So there will be a kind of selection of clips from the Civil War series that you edited.
Yes.
You can't show the whole thing because they would have to sleep there for...
Yeah, the whole series is 11 hours long. So yeah. What I did is I put together about an hour's worth of clips. And I tried to... Meredith had given me an outline of what the exhibit would contain. So I tried to choose clips that reflected what the themes in the exhibit were as well. So I think that that'll work a pretty good conjunction between the two, I hope. The biggest part, as you know, of our film is the use of still photographs. And as Meredith was talking about these daguerreotypes and ambertypes of the soldiers, we use them extensively in the film. And so many of the clips feature their faces. For example, I'm doing the Emancipation Proclamation sequence with Lincoln. And there's a great quote about the meaning of the Emancipation Proclamation and how it changed the attitude of many of the Union soldiers, that it actually gave them a higher purpose for fighting the war in order to free the slaves. And during the reading of that quote is a whole montage of these unknown soldiers from the daguerreotypes. And the emotion that they create looking in their faces while this one soldier is relating how the purpose has gotten higher because of the proclamation. It's a very moving moment in the film. And so I think you'll see the beauty of the conjunction of these photographs with the text in the context of the history of the war itself. The other thing I chose, for example, too, was because of the Coal Mountain Opera this summer, I chose to include the sequence on the crater, which is the opening scene in the novel, The Battle of the Crater, on the outskirts of Petersburg, which was a horrendous event in the war itself, a major mistake and a huge loss of life. But again, I thought I would include that in conjunction with the exhibit and the opera itself. It's a three-minute sequence. It's not particularly long, but there's some wonderful photographs, again, of the soldiers setting up before the crater battle begins, and also a couple of great paintings of the battle itself. So it'll, again, give the audience a little bit of context for what the opera is about.
What was it like for you? I mean, this film is from 1990. To watch it now, 25 years later?
I mean, to me, two things happened. One is that I was surprised at how well it's held up. I mean, it's always considered to be one of the best pieces of historical documentary filmmaking ever made. I couldn't speak to that myself. But I was actually blown away watching it again at how powerful it was. Having known what was in the film very intimately, having worked on it for two and a half years, I was still brought to tears many times during the course of rewatching the film.
I just rewatched the first episode last night, and at the end there's a letter by a soldier from Rhode Island named Sullivan Ballou.
Yes.
And I was reduced to a heap of blithering ectoplasm on my couch. It was so beautifully written and so moving and heartfelt.
Oh, it's, again, I put that clip into the reel as well. So it's the second clip that we'll be presenting that night. It's a very, very special moment in the film. The way the letter came to us is we had a historical consultant named Bill Luchtenberg, who's one of the major history professors at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And Bill and Ken had had a relationship for quite a while, and Bill was often consulting on the films almost from the beginning. And when they had their first consultant meeting, at the meeting, Bill pulled out of his wallet the Sullivan Ballou letter and gave it to Ken and said, "This might be something you might be interested in including." And Ken read it, and he was dissolved into tears just on reading it on paper. And so it became the closing sequence of episode one, because this soldier was killed at Bull Run, which is the last battle in the first episode. And it to this day, Ken actually carries that letter still in his wallet.
I mean, I would too, because it speaks, and we don't want to ruin it for people who are going to go see it, and I think everybody should go, actually, if you can, watch the clips that night at the Lenzic, not to mention rewatch the whole series if you haven't seen it, ladies and gentlemen. But I think it speaks to something, and the Civil War speaks to so many issues of our own time, but that letter in particular was a letter about what it means to fight for something bigger than yourself, bigger than your family, bigger than your children. Mm-hmm. What it means to believe so deeply in your government that you are willing to give your life so that that great project can continue.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it is striking because I do think that, especially when the Emancipation Proclamation came out, I mean, prior to the Emancipation, many of the Union soldiers felt they were fighting to free the slaves. Others were, it wasn't quite clear to them exactly what the purpose of the war was. It just seemed to be between a battle between states' rights. But for Sullivan Ballou, who was a Northerner and had grown up in an abolitionist family, it the Civil War actually did mean a great deal. I think when you think about the military and the sacrifices that soldiers make, when there is a really strong purpose to what they're fighting for, then I think their approach to the possibility of death is far different than soldiers who are clueless as to, why am I here? I mean, for example, the soldiers who have to go and fight in Iraq and are wondering, why are we going and fighting in Iraq, or why are we going to Afghanistan? In many cases, more recent military battles, wars that we've been involved in, the whole purpose of them is so unclear, basically unknown, that you have to wonder, is the sacrifice these men are making in these purposeless wars worth it?
Yeah.
In the case of the Civil War, I think it really was.
We're talking to Paul Barnes and Meredith Davidson about the Civil War exhibition opening at the New Mexico History Museum tonight and the Civil War documentary film series. And I have to ask you, I mean, having worked with Ken Burns, who's a filmmaker I admire so much, what is that collaboration like between you as an editor and a filmmaker and this particular collaboration?
It's a very, very close collaboration between the editor and the director. Basically, the editor is the last creative person involved in the project, so that I always feel a great responsibility that I need to make the vision of this film that the director has in mind as clear to the audience as possible, because I'm the last set of creative hands the film goes through before it goes to the audience. And again, I feel a great deal of responsibility to the director to make sure that his vision is coming through as strongly as possible. And with Ken, it was a very easy collaboration. It was like we were simpatico almost from day one when we first worked together in 1984 on the Statue of Liberty. The very first day, I just knew that I had found my director. Many editors go through a whole career looking for their director. The very first day of the Statue of Liberty, I knew I had found him. And when we finished that project, he said to me, I'm planning this series on the Civil War. He asked me, would you come back and work with me on that? I said, I will be there in a heartbeat and do it with you. And again, the collaboration on the Civil War was a really rich and rewarding one. Ken is an excellent editor unto himself. I mean, he could easily cut his own films. He's got a great visual sense, a great sense of timing. His choice of music is absolutely wonderful. And what keeps striking the both of us is how simpatico we are in all those areas. We've worked together now for such a long time that he barely has to say anything to me and often allows me a first cut because I know so well what he likes that I can put something together very quickly that he can then react to. And then we go and make changes from there. But it's almost like we were of one mind right from the first day that we worked together.
Now, as editor, and especially, I mean, as you go along in the process of working together one film after another, do you ever say, before the filming starts, we need this, this, and that? Or is that really his job?
It's by and large the director's job. But again, because our collaboration has become so rich, there's always these pre-production meetings at which we begin to discuss what might be needed to have the film come across. Or if we've already discovered that there's a lack of photographs or stock footage in certain areas, what is the live material that we're going to shoot to cover that with color cinematography? Are we going to attempt any sort of recreations, you know, to bring something more to life? Those kind of discussions go on, and he often involves me in those early on in the process so that it can be accepted or rejected as a part of the plan for the production of the film.
I mean, watching the Civil War series, it has to be so challenging to edit a film where there's no actual footage from the time that you are spending 11 hours talking about.
Exactly. Well, one interesting thing of working on the Civil War, again, we were aware of that problem, especially with the battle sequences. The photographs are usually of the battlefields before the battles and then afterwards with all the dead bodies. During the actual course of the fighting, the cameramen were nowhere to be found. They were hiding. The exposure time was so long that they couldn't possibly, you know, photograph the action at that particular time. And so part of our problem in putting it together, and again, I've included a clip in next Friday's event, which is the Battle of Little Round Top. And very often what we'll do is we'll see the empty landscapes of the battlefields, but what we do with the soundtrack is that we create the whole sound of battle. So you hear the rifle fire, the musket fire, the cannon fire, all the explosions. You hear men yelling and screaming and running, so that the soundtrack becomes an active fight. And if you put that over the empty battlefields and you do these slow zoom-ins or pans that Ken is famous for, the audience's imagination awakens. It's almost as if they feel like, because of what they're hearing, they feel like they're seeing it as well.
Yeah.
And the narration is telling the story, and you can almost imagine the Southerners trying to climb up, you know, attacking the slope of Little Round Top and trying to get to the top. You can imagine the Northerners who are hiding behind those boulders and trying to fire down and protect themselves. And one of the funny things happened is that after the series was first on, many people would come up to Ken and said, "Where did you get that newsreel footage of the Battle of Gettysburg?" And Ken would go, "There's no newsreel footage. It's pre-film. It's pre-movie." But it was just, you know, they had thought that they were watching newsreel because the sound effects helped to make it
Isn't
come alive.
Isn't that amazing? That is.
Wow.
Talk about theater of the mind.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, this is something I wanted to ask both of you. I mean, here we are living in a time, and there's really been no time in the history of the United States since the Civil War where we aren't dealing with really severe racial problems. And right now the focus is on police shooting unarmed black men, but they've always been doing it. It's just there's maybe more cameras now or more awareness. Focusing on the Civil War, how does it help you to think about our own time?
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you just go back to the beginnings of the founding of this country, I mean, we were basically founded on a misconception. If we're saying all men are created equal, but we have, you know, 20 million slaves in the country, it's not quite true. And from the time of the creation of our nation until the Civil War occurred, there was a constant struggle over that dichotomy between, you know, the ideals in which we were founded and the actualities of what was happening. I think as time went on and the nation began to grow up, more and more people began to feel that inequity and that something had to be done. Politicians in Congress, presidents, they kept trying to compromise and trying to figure out a way to abolish it. Europe was way ahead of us in abolishing slavery far before we did. But because the South had created this culture and this economy that was so dependent on slavery, it was almost an impossibility to get rid of it, at least through any kind of diplomatic or political solution. It almost had to come to this crisis where we had to actually fight this horrendous war in order for the country to break and then re-heal itself. The saddest thing to me is that Lincoln, who was probably our greatest president, the most unfortunate thing is, had he not died and had he been the president who oversaw the beginnings of Reconstruction and then possibly as an ex-president who could continue to have a say in what that would be, had that happened, I think the country would have been much different. I think we would have gotten off on a much better foot in terms of, you know, incorporating the emancipated slaves into our society and beginning to think of them more as equals. It was every president and every administration after Lincoln was so incompetent that Reconstruction and all the ideals of Reconstruction completely fell apart over the course of time.
Yeah.
And gradually were forgotten. Segregation goes into place and Jim Crow laws go into place and they stay in place for almost, you know, 100 years. And that's really unfortunate. And the saddest thing to me is that I also think that, you know, as a person growing up in the 60s and seeing the civil rights movement being so successful and feeling that over the 30-year period of time that we were making some inroads in making things more equal, the events of what's happening now are really disturbing to me because I almost feel like racism is suddenly on a rise again in this country. It has to do with the kind of conservative drift the country has taken, and that conservatism is actually rubbing off on a lot of our younger generation. And so that they feel a little more free to be making racist comments that 10, 15 years ago would have been unthinkable. So it's a sad time, I think, in our country's history. And I think it's one reason why we need to go back to our past and reexamine the Civil War and why was it fought and why was slavery so bad and why was this inequality so bad and begin to, again, think about and look at that from that perspective. And it might change some people's minds.
I think going back to look at our past to engage with the issues that are happening today is so important. That's one of the things that as curators, it's our responsibility to do. And I think that one of the interesting aspects of working on this exhibit with two other curators, it was a collaborative project between myself and Daniel Kosharik, our photo curator, and Tom Leach, the director of Palace Press, was looking at the ways that generation after generation after generation have looked towards the Civil War as a moment of figuring out what it means to be an American. And I think a lot of these issues that are coming up in Baltimore or Ferguson to what happened in Albuquerque with, you know, what's going on with the police violence in Albuquerque, that in some ways can be tied to race, in some ways can be tied to other issues, but is going back to what it means to be an American and grappling with those questions, and that many of those definitions come out of the results of the Civil War and are things that have been re-churned and re-churned and are still being, you know, figured out. I love this statistic that since the Civil War, 65,000 books have been published on the topic of the Civil War, which is more than one per day since then, which is just phenomenal. So if you
that means nobody's read them all.
Paul has.
No, hardly.
Well, the exhibition is called Fading Memories, Echoes of the Civil War. It opens tonight at the New Mexico History Museum at 5 o'clock?
At 5 o'clock. And actually, you should definitely come because it's really going to be an exciting opening. We have the New Mexico Territorial Brass Band is coming to play live music. We have refreshments and food provided by the Women's Board of the New Mexico Museum Foundation. And we have a really wonderful woman who's a reenactor who is going to talk about women in the Civil War and their role. And she comes from a large group of volunteers that come every year to Los Golondrinas, which is a historic ranch here in town. And over the course of this weekend, they're actually doing an entire weekend's worth of Civil War events. So that's something that is almost like we're giving a little mini preview of some of those things that people can be doing over the weekend at Golondrinas.
Mm-hmm. And there are so many events going on, and we talked about the Friday, the 8th of May.
And that event is open. It's free to the public. You don't need to do tickets in advance. Just come.
Just show up and see clips of the Civil War selected by Paul Barnes. But there's so many other things happening through the summer and really through the fall, the beginning of next year. So I guess people will just have to go to nmhistorymuseum.org to find out more. I want to thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. Meredith Davidson is curator of 19th and 20th century Southwest collections at the New Mexico History Museum, and Paul Barnes is film editor and collaborator with filmmaker Ken Burns, editor of the Civil War series. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.